Welcome to the Command Line Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. It's good to be back on the mic. A couple of reasons why I've missed the last few episodes. Actually, nothing too terrible. It's not the massive weather that rolled in as you might think. I mean, that was definitely a part of it. But actually spending a bit more time on some of my other passions outside of technology. If you're curious about those, you should check out my other, much newer podcast, The Audio Diary of a Peculiar Character, the link for which I'll drop into the show notes. I'm going to talk about, in the upcoming weeks, a bit more of why I've missed, actually, episodes for both podcasts in the last little bit. Fair warning, going forward, I am thinking about launching a new project, again, unrelated to technology, much more rooted in my passion for brewing and beer, which I've not been shy about sharing here, and that might take some time away from the reading and writing that I do that informed this podcast, but I think the schedule has been fluid and flexible enough that it'll come when it comes. I do have some other essays that I am working on. I'm still very passionate about certain technology topics and dedicated to invigorating a much more consistent writing habit, but I do want to be frank about how juggling and balancing all of these things might affect this podcast in particular. Do stay tuned to the website. I'll try to post updates there in terms of how things evolve and how that balance is going. It's kind of early days yet, but I am glad to be able to get back and share a bit of a newscast. I will admit that over the last few weeks, there really hasn't been that much standing out, and there might be off weeks just as a consequence of what's in the news. So just to be prepared for that, and those would be good opportunities going forward if I get this writing habit going, to share other things, to share much deeper thoughts on particular topics, rather than necessarily doing the topical show week in and week out. One other thing before I do get into some of the stories that did catch my eye this week is just some travel updates. I did not make it out to the Southern California Linux Expo exactly because of the weather that came in that very same weekend. I'm bitterly disappointed that I didn't get out for that. It's not looking likely that I'm going to get out to Libra Planet either, but that's because I lucked into a discount and, well, my employer being willing to pay for another conference around the same time out in San Francisco. So the week of March the 7th through the 11th, pretty much for the whole week from Monday through Friday, although I'll be flying in on Monday and flying out on Friday, I'll be at Fluent. This is a JavaScript conference put on by O'Reilly that looks great, has some great speakers, and because I'll be there all week long, looks like I'll actually have a fair amount of free time. So if there are folks who want to hit any of the beer spots of note in downtown San Francisco, or that might be reachable by an Uber or public transit, drop me a note. Let me know. I'm happy to meet up either at the conference, if there are other listeners out there who are also planning to go, or if there are folks in and around the San Francisco area that might want to get together. I've shared at least one story, maybe a few more than that, over the years about the sort of interesting adoption of things from the makerspace into more established institutions, in particular public libraries. There's been at least one, maybe a handful of libraries that have looked at how to bring in aspects of what are very otherwise community-oriented pursuits in the DIY space into kind of the more staid surrounds of stacks and information access, really embracing that that core idea of service to a community, a place to gather, to learn, regardless of that's from books or from hands-on experience. I'm glad to see this New York Times piece, Woodshop Enters the Age of High Tech by John Swartz, that looks at the continuation of this, that this is a trend that is continuing, even if it's not making headlines on a regular basis. This is a particular one out in the West Coast, and it's at the intersection of the massive online course provider movement, as well as the maker spaces, and trying to find an intersection with more sort of traditional pedagogy, this time in the form more of reinvigorating this idea of shop classes. And it totally makes sense if you think about this, tinkering as a form of teaching in this environment. I definitely feel growing up that I was in a generation that was kind of in a gap where shop, either auto shop or wood shop, had kind of passed its peak and was just not being offered, and regretted that there's a certain handiness that I was not able to cultivate when I was much younger. And now to see that reinvigorated in a way that is much more focused in on the kinds of skills, interests, and just circumstance that we find ourselves in now. So it might reinvigorate some of those traditional skills of woodcraft, of automotive repair, of tinkering, of just being able to resuscitate the things around you rather than throwing your hands up and buying something new. It's kind of cool, along with a lot of new stuff too, like 3D printing, 3D design, bringing other forms of computing technology in, and the ways that we've seen writ large really in the popularity and staying power of the maker movement. So very pleased to see this. I encourage you to check this out and continue to keep an eye out for these kinds of intersections in the communities around you, and do what you can to bolster and support this, because I think that it really has legitimate staying power, even if it's not something that the current tech news or popular media is covering as much as we might otherwise like. At least once, on the occasion of Independence Day here in the United States, I have shared with you my reading of John Perry Barlow's seminal The Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. That, this past week, celebrated its 20th anniversary. That's incredible to me, that these ideas of thinking about online spaces in a way that are independent and broadly minded, crossing jurisdictions, breaking down traditional ways of thinking about how we organize, who we are, how we constitute ourselves into larger groups, that boggles my mind. That's been around this long. Admittedly, in reading it even a few years ago, some of the things there are a bit more aspirational, perhaps a little more dated than what the reality, at least of the last handful of years, has revealed in terms of how internet access and organizing online have actually manifested. But I think that this is important. I think there are definitely aspects of Barlow's work on the 20th anniversary of him sharing it are important to bear in mind. We've definitely talked a lot more about mass surveillance, the threats to privacy and security online, the opportunities for individual public activism to push back against that, to bolster the public interest, to make sure that we have the right kinds of balances, maybe not the sort of free-for-all independent state that Barlow had in mind, but something very strongly informed by that, something that we should, in many ways, I think, hew much closer to than we've managed to, not through, I think, a lack of desire or ability on our part, but just through circumstance and the forces that are often arrayed against us. So it's worth taking a look here. Corey has a nice write-up on Boing Boing. This is amongst a couple of other people that have picked up this celebration of this seminal document. And it's worth a revisit to think about what aspects of this are evergreen and constantly topical, and even those things that are a bit more historical that might add a bit of texture to the current debate, to the current focus, and how we continue to push for a certain amount of independence and liberty in these online spaces. Speaking of the perpetual struggle and the current state of affairs, a really good piece to kind of catch you up on some of the key components, especially around the very heated debate right now about encryption and public policy, is a piece at MIT's Technology Review by Tom Simonite. This is very readable, and I think does a good job of, if you haven't been paying very close attention, or you're just struggling for a handle because there's been a proliferation of news and a lot of headlines, you want a more cohesive narrative to understand what has unfolded over the last handful of years post-Snowden in terms of the pressure from law enforcers, from federal agencies, both here in the U.S. and elsewhere, to get backdoors, to weaken encryption, and why it remains important and who is on the side of defending that importance to have strong crypto. This is well worth a read. It's not just a historical perspective, although I think that's a very important component to see that this is part of a trend line that in many ways actually traces back a couple of decades to the first crypto war, but has its own sort of cadence and important moments more recently. But also the prospects for the future and in this particular moment that we're at, where we're seeing an interesting sort of intersection in between the desire to keep people safe, which I don't fault in any way, but also that liberty can't be at the expense of that, that we need ways to preserve our privacy. It's not about whether we have something to hide or not. And that not all the threats are necessarily on a policy footing, that it's not just about that tension between law enforcers trying to do what's already a very difficult job in the face of these rapidly changing and a very hard to parse technology for non-experts, but also that when we do have strong alignment about the value of strong crypto, if we're all on the same page, or we just cabin ourselves to those who are on the side of defending encryption technologies, it's hard to get it right. It's hard to get it right without the distractions of these kinds of debates, without the perpetual attacks from all corners. And this is a good reminder of that as well. It's worth taking a look at, again, to a little bit perspectively, touches on some nice quotes from routine players in the space, some of the best champions, most realistic champions of where we're at and where we need to be. So definitely check this one out. I kind of wish it was Thursday, because this next story is a little bit of a throwback. This goes back to definitely when I first really started using Linux in earnest. This is this SCO case against IBM about key aspects of the intellectual property, the heart of the Linux kernel. I was as much surprised that this was still ongoing as, well, pleasantly surprised that in this case, the fact that it is, the last couple arguments turned in the case are in favor of IBM and by extension, the larger community. Really, the more I think about this, the more I have to wonder if this is relevant, and not on a legal basis, but just that differential between how lawyers and legislators prosecute these sorts of things versus how rapidly Linux itself, the kernel itself, has evolved and changed in the time since this case first came up. Are the claims themselves still of merit if the technology, the bits of code in question have been refactored, rewritten, changed out? I don't know. I couldn't even begin to assess that. But I think that at this point, given how late in the day this case is, that's one that if the judges aren't looking at it, they increasingly need to. That maybe that's the most fruitful way to end this, is to say time and place, these arguments might have been valid at one point, but the community keeps moving on, technology keeps moving on, and the very same reason that myself and others have been surprised that this case is still out there actually has its root in the fact that these things change, that technology changes in a way where if you're not able to pin things down within a very short time scale of a few months or a year, that it then just doesn't matter, because the churn means that the shape of it looks very, very different in a still surprisingly short amount of time. Speaking about the weird disconnect between legislators, policymakers, and technologists, there was an interesting piece on Tech Dirt by one of my very favorite tech journalists, bar none, Glenn Moody, this time about the current state of TAFTA and TTIP. This is the later day incarnation of ACTA, of earlier trade agreements trying to continue to normalize copyright regimes, intellectual property enforcement regimes across multiple jurisdictions. What's noteworthy about this is not anything substantive about the body of this particular trade agreement, but is a much more sort of subjective and anecdotal story from one of the people able to actually look at this document. This reminds me in reading it not so much of, I don't know, I don't have a lot of experience with this sort of process and bureaucracy, But it reminds me of my work volunteering some years ago in the National Archives. And in those circumstances, in that venue, the kind of strictures make sense where you're dealing with something that is very rare and very precious, and you want to make sure that it remains accessible to researchers, to the public, for a very long time. So you keep things under very close control so that they're not damaged or lost, not because you're trying to lock it down, perversely because you're trying to make sure that it endures. This just is a massive disconnect when we're dealing with something that is new, that is a moment in time, that is a trade agreement that might be superseded in the next handful of years when some further iteration of it comes out. And it just, it seems at odds to read through what the person in this account went through in order to get just a couple of hours to try to read, analyze, and they still can't actually share any of what they found coming out of that. They can only talk about just the experience around this trade agreement. It just seems out of joint with what I think otherwise we all can agree is what increasingly open societies are striving for, is transparency, is inclusiveness, is the kind of consultation to make sure that the public interest is served, that the right kinds of balances and compromises are struck. And this is very, very, I think, antithetical to that idea, given just how tightly controlled this seems. So it's worth giving a read. If you're not following these sorts of trade agreements closely on the core subject matter, I think this is eyebrow-raising just in terms of giving you a sense of how defensive those who have a stake counter to the public interest, have in this, and how they're trying to push out the kind of scrutiny that would ensure that we strike the right kinds of balances, better kinds of balances, to make sure that all interests are served as well as possible. One of the trends that I follow very closely is how well Moore's Law is actually playing out. I was pleased to see a piece by Peter Bright on Ars Technica that spoke very directly to that question. In it, he actually contends in a headline that at first glance would seem to be a bit clickbaity about Moore's Law really being dead this time around. He actually bears that out, that a lot of the sort of strategic road mapping that the chip industry has been going through recently has shifted more towards sort of a formulation other than following the rough doubling of compute power at the same price point. He bolsters this quite well in terms of both going back into the history of the Intel co-founder Gordon Moore and his formulation, again, just based on sheer improvements in manufacturing processes that resulted in doubling densities of transistors per computer dies, up to the present, where that does seem to be running into physical limitations. When we talk about things at a 10 nanometer scale, we run into quantum effects that make it hard to do computation, basically anything electronic, in a consistent and reliable way. It's kind of interesting that he looks forward to, doesn't dig into as much, although Ars Technica generally as an outlet covers this quite well, sort of post-silicon, whether it's graphene-based chips, quantum computing, other ways of doing computation that might pick up where Moore's Law leaves off, but also looking at, and I think this is much more tantalizing, where if we have so much that we can squeeze into a computer die, it's not just the general purpose processors that we put on there. We may still have a few of those. In this world of many core, that many of the cores that actually do get composed together into the chips that we see increasingly in mobile devices and appliances and things beyond traditional sort of desktop computers, it is the built to purpose sensors, specialized processors, whether those are GPUs, ASICs, DSPs, things of that nature, that have more sort of a heterogeneous value, in that they add together in a way that means that it's not about raw compute capability. It's not about the number of operations per second, but the kinds of capabilities that are available per second or per tick that become increasingly interesting. So this is worth a read, very readable in terms of otherwise a dry subject, and well worth taking a look. The last story is a study that came to me by way of BBC in my feeds, but has been picked up, I've seen, by quite a few other outlets. And it's one that suggests that when the consideration of pull requests, contributions to software projects, are blinded, so we don't know much about, in particular, the gender of those making contributions, that on average, the contributions of women are deemed to be of much higher quality, much higher value. There's been some pushback, understandably, especially in the world of technology, where these kinds of contentions about the value of diversity are met by the incumbents in a way that, I find discouraging and a little gutting, that this isn't peer-reviewed or what have you. But I honestly think that this makes sense, maybe not on a purely empirical basis, although I would love to see this reproduce. I would love to see a much more deep study of this to throw more data at this. But I think that this resonates very strongly with an earlier study that I saw about recruiting practices in the world of technology, that when similar blinding was put into effect, that candidates really shone through on their strength regardless of factors like gender, race, what have you, about core competency and contribution, and that there's a lot of systemic bias that we still need to do a lot of work to overcome. But on the much more constructive and positive side, that this bolsters this idea that if we have a diversity of experience, opinion, views, and expertise, that that is to the good no matter what. And I think that that's the really important takeaway here, is that we need to work harder to recognize the work that people do, the contributions that they can make, the additions that they can bring into cultures and projects in ways that really harnesses that, that I think we're diminished by being skeptical about studies like this, about not thinking about our cognitive biases and being able to step back and think about things in a more rational light that admit the kinds of contributions that we might otherwise be closed off to. So I encourage you to take a look at this original piece. I look forward to any kind of feedback. I think that we need some more robust discussion. I'm happy to add my voice in support of diversity, and would like to see more in this vein. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to record a bit of audio with your smart device and send it to the same place. Until next time, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.